for those who are just walking in, I have some handouts, and but only 25, so you might look with the person next to you. They're not absolutely essential, so we can kind of as a reference point. So we'll have to kind of make do. I can't get my head around the fact that at 3:45 in the afternoon, on the most perfect day of the year, this many people would assemble to talk about religious pluralism. I'm used to teaching college students. I have to check in to make sure that they show up. And they're, you know, so it's so great to see you all here today. My name is Carla Sumula, and as I mentioned, we're going to be taking a look at religious pluralism in America. We began yesterday by looking at a pretty extreme case, viewing slots or excerpts from a film called Divided We Fall, America and the Aftermath, aftermath of 9/11, and taking a look at some of the interaction between different religious communities, between how Americans view people of other faiths, how they sometimes feel threatened. We also continued to talk about what makes someone an American, kind of a complicated discussion. It's a complicated term to define. In that setting, in that film, the case we looked at was the murder of Balbir Sodhi, a gas station owner in Mesa, Arizona, just 4 days after September 11th. He was murdered in front of his station, shot 5 times in the back by somebody who assumed that he was a Muslim and was out to, it was a revenge killing. Knew nothing about the man. What the film goes on and the clip goes on to show us is that this man was not Muslim at all, which doesn't excuse it. Nobody but should be killing anybody, regardless of their tradition. But he was a Sikh. Sikh men in particular wear turbans. And after 9/11 and even before that, the idea became particularly strong that turban equals terrorist. All right? And that was a dominant image in our minds. Right, and came to play a huge role. That case is particularly sobering. That was it was hard to even watch, for those of you who are here, to even watch those short clips. It's just devastating to think, how could that happen in our nation? How could that happen down the street from us? How could that happen to people we know who participate in our communities? And so in some ways, it was even hard to even think, where do we go from here? Like I said, that is going to be, I'm kind of framing this week with sort of the extreme. We're not going to be looking at murders in the name of God for the rest of the week. Today is a much more mundane type of interreligious encounter, probably a lot more typical, probably a lot closer to what many of you could find yourselves involved in, right? And that's going to be taking a look at the National Day of Prayer in Troy, Michigan. But before we get started on that, I'd just like to take a moment to tell you a little bit more about why I'm interested in this. I've talked to a number of you now individually, and I've mentioned that I teach Bible and Judaism. What am I doing with religious pluralism? Part of my training, I went to a Jewish seminary for my PhD, Hebrew Union Seminary, or Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, Ohio, the largest and oldest Reformed seminary in the world. In doing that, I studied with Jewish students. All my professors were Jewish, and I studied Hebrew Bible there, Old Testament, and I studied the texts of Judaism, Mishnah and Talmud and Midrash. And that is really forms the core of my training. It is in that experience that my passion for interreligious encounters really began to take shape. It's not where it began, but where it really began to take on contours. The program that I participated in, this PhD program at Hebrew Union College, was started after World War II. It was started out in the original title was called the Christian Fellows Program. They can only imagine men doing PhDs in religion in the late 40s. And it was started by the Jewish seminary in America in order to help promote understanding between Christians and Jews after World War II and the Holocaust. It was part of the never again should this happen idea. And it was an educational effort to say, maybe we should study together. Maybe we should open our doors to each other. Maybe we should learn from each other. That Christian Fellows program, which started as a short-term study program for Christian scholars, then quickly became a PhD program. By the time I showed up at Hebrew Union College in the mid-90s, it had been long established. And I went through that program as a Christian and, you know, having been preceded by many before me. I felt an obligation after that experience. Not duty, saying I must do this, but I profoundly felt compelled to bring that experience to other settings. I thought, this Jewish seminary has fully funded me, which is a big deal in graduate school, to learn with and from them, and together with them. And I went out, and my first job was 1 year teaching position at Capital University, a Lutheran school in Columbus, Ohio. And then from there, I took the job I'm still at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where I teach Bible and Judaism. And as soon as I started in Decorah, I started, and at Luther, I started becoming more and more involved in interreligious dialogue. The first group that I became at a national and then now an international level. The first group that I started participating and I still work with today is the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, their consultative panel on Jewish Lutheran relations. So I've been working with them for over 7 years now. We just published a book together called Covenantal Conversations, trying to explain Judaism to Christians, right? And it comes with a full study guide. It's been published by Augsburg Fortress. Another group that I participated in, kind of as an offshoot from there, and I still participate in, it's called the Christian Scholars Group on Jewish-Christian Relations, and that's out of Boston College, and so I go there once or twice a year, and it's scholars who are trying to focus their scholarship in areas that will promote understanding between Christians and Jews. The group that I most recently joined, and I've become one of the planners, it's called the Shalom Hartman Theology Conference, and it's held in Jerusalem in February each year. And so I go for a week, and Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scholars from around the world, there are a group of 45 of us, who meet together, and we study each other's texts intensively for a week in Jerusalem. And these are some of the groups that I have come to participate in and work from in terms of understanding interfaith relations. So it started out as Jewish-Christian. It's now expanded to Jewish-Christian-Muslim relations. And I've set out my goal for my sabbatical year. I started in May. I am learning Arabic because I decided if I'm sitting out at the dialogue table with Jews and Muslims, I speak Hebrew, modern Hebrew, and now it's time that I learn Arabic. So I'm working on these skills as I go along because I found that this is a calling. This is a calling, and it's a privilege to be able to participate in the world today where this can happen. It has not always been so. Just to give you a little background, the era of interreligious dialogue, of the ecumenical movement, can be dated. Right? And it's dated by many, and there's certainly not a precise date. But if we want a date, we can look back to September 1893 at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago, which was part of the, if anybody else knows what was going on in Chicago 1893?
World's Fair.
It was piggybacked along with that, yes. So it was the World's Parliament on Religions. And it was planned largely by Christian organizers, Protestants, and 10 major world religions were represented there. Christians were the dominant group, but there were 10 groups there. And they met together and they gave speeches and presentations and they talked together and they learned from each other for about 2 weeks in that September, that fall of 1893. That was a remarkable event both on the American scene and it extended to Europe, because that was really kind of where we can sort of put the beginning of the modern interfaith or interreligious movement. Now, that World Parliament of Religions was kind of an interesting event. And there are records, transcripts still available on the speeches that were given by the different members of the communities that were there. And some are remarkably radical. I have to read them a few times to think, wow, that was well over 100 years ago. One of the speakers at that parliament who made a huge impact on his audience, this very mixed audience, was a Hindu practitioner. His name was Swami Vivekananda. And he was quite the figure, very dramatic and a very powerful speaker. And I'm doing some quoting from this book that I mentioned yesterday. It's by Diana Eck. It's called A Spiritual Journey from Bozeman to Benares. It's an excellent text and a wonderful read. She's an academic, but this doesn't read like an academic text. At any rate, she talks about this presentation in which Swami Vivekananda addressed those assembled. He said, "Sisters and brothers of America, to belong to a religion that has taught the world both tolerance and universal acceptance, it is a privilege for me to be here." So in terms of taking a look at his own tradition. He was also very challenging as he looked at this group assembled in Chicago. He said, "It is the same light coming through different colors," as he describes Hinduism. "But in the heart of everything, the same truth reigns. The Lord has declared to the Hindu in his incarnation as Krishna, I am in every religion as a thread through a string of pearls. And wherever you see extraordinary holiness and extraordinary power raising and purifying humanity, you will know that I am there." So that sense that he was already connecting these different traditions. It made people there uncomfortable. It makes people today uncomfortable. Buddhists made presentations there, and some of them issued challenges as well to those in the audience. The Sri Lankan Buddhist reformer Dharampala, asked the audience in the lecture hall. He said, "How many of you have read of the life of Buddha?" How many here? Maybe we should try that. How many of you have read the life of Buddha? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's great. That's more than what happened there. Only 5 raised their hands in 1893. And he continued, he said, 5 only? 475 million of people accept our religion of love and hope. And these are primarily Americans. He says, "You call yourselves a nation, a great nation, and yet you do not know the history of this great teacher. How dare you judge us?" Can you imagine? 1893, those are some fighting words. But it's a good point. It was a good point. Another Buddhist at his presentation was equally challenging. He stood up and he pointed to the very explicit anti-Japanese attitude that was so prominent in the United States at that time and for a long time afterward. And he said to the group assembled, he said, as he mentioned the signs that say, "No Japanese is allowed to enter here." He said, "This is what I've seen in Chicago." And he said, "If such be the Christian ethics, well, we are perfectly satisfied being heathens." That's some strong language. Then he went on to say, he said, "The Japanese are not so concerned," he said, "whether someone is called a Buddhist, a Shintoist, or a Christian." He said, "It's the consistency of doctrine and conduct which we judge. Do walk the walk." Yeah, those are some interesting statements made by these folks. Finally, another interesting presentation was made by a Muslim. Only one Muslim was at this World Parliament of Religions. And he was an American convert, and his name was Mohammed Webb from the East Coast. And he traveled extensively in the Middle East. But he says, and here's his presentation to the group, he says, there is not a Muslim on earth who does not believe that ultimately Islam will be the universal faith. Kind of interesting, and you could put, and you could have a Christian standing up at that point and saying precisely the same thing, but putting Christian in there. He went on, he said, I have not returned to the United States to make you all Muslims in spite of yourselves. I do not propose to take a sword in one hand and the Quran in the other and go through the world killing every man who does not say there is no God but one and Muhammad is the prophet of God. But I have faith in the American intellect, he said, and in the American love of fair play, and will defy any intelligent man to understand Islam and not love it. Over 100 years ago, he said he had faith in the American intellect and the American sense of fair play. And where are we today with Islam? Yeah. It's kind of remarkable that this assembly was even held. And other presentations like that were held. Like I said, though, it was dominated by Christian presentations. And the kind of theology present in most of those Christian presentations was one that is called a fulfillment theology, a theology of Christian fulfillment. This idea was that all roads will eventually lead to Christianity. Christianity is the crowning glory of all of these different world religions. And when they all see the light, they'll all be like us. That was the tone, and that was considered very liberal. Very liberal and understanding. Right? So that was kind of the tone that was set. From then on, many such interfaith, interreligious dialogues and conventions and congresses and the study of comparative religion, programs like that were set up in universities in the United States. They were very controversial, to say the least. Getting a comparative religion program into places like Harvard, it didn't come easily and it didn't come early. That's kind of like setting the ground for where we are. This is not a new thing, or this is not, it is a new thing in some ways that we're trying to do. This idea of working with each other as people of different faiths and trying to understand where we each come from. Before we get to the case study, which I'll give you an outline of in the next few minutes, I'd like you to talk to the person next to you for a moment. When was the first time, if you had one, that you perhaps attended a worship service or were in a religious community very different than your own? Do you remember that? Participating, watching, talk to the person next to you. Do you remember it? I hate to break this up. We'll talk more, I promise. Does anybody care to share your first memory of such an experience? What kind of experience was it? Anybody?
A wedding.
Oh, and that, you know, that's very, very common where you venture out of your own tradition when you go to somebody's wedding. Maybe for a coworker or something like that. What kind of tradition did you go to?
Well, it was a blended marriage of a Christian and a Muslim, right, Joe?
Oh, yeah.
And so they actually blended the service of one Christian pastor and one Muslim, and we did all kinds of different things.
What were your reactions during the service?
I was pretty open to trying. They had some lovely, wonderful bell ringing and chanting things. And
so it was appealing in some ways. Interesting.
It was healing and really interesting, just looking at the level of sincerity and, yeah.
So you felt that there was, that the divine God was there, even in this sort of mixed setting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Somebody else? Yes?
I attended a bar mitzvah for a Sephardic Orthodox Jewish friend.
Wow, and where was that?
It was in Seattle, a bus with Seattle.
What kinds of reactions did you have?
Well, I knew what I was going to enter because I'd actually had him fill in my practice of group health for a year. So
okay.
That's how I got there, and I'd watched him pray before he'd eat and all these sorts of things. It worked. Right.
But a bar mitzvah, that's a new ballgame. Pretty remarkable, yeah.
Native American Sundance.
And where did you see that?
Black Hills. It was not a commercial one.
So not for a ticket through Ticketmaster.
No,
for
yourself.
Well, what were some of your reactions? What did you?
It was very reverent.
So did that surprise you in some ways?
No, because I knew some of the people participating before.
There's always a connection. You see the thread. You go to some place because usually a friend, an acquaintance, somebody that you already care about is involved.
I have a little different experience. I'm a musician, and I used to play at a synagogue. And I loved it because, you know, the scriptures and everything, and there's some beautiful traditions. But then the last Sunday I was there, there was some open discussion, and the people talked about Christians, and, you know, we can't let these Christians. It was very negative, but that's the only negative thing I experienced.
So it was a little shocking.
It was, and I didn't know what to do with that.
You know, and you take a look at some of the experiences that go on in Christian churches where they throw around every Sunday in the gospel reading, nearly every Sunday, the Jews, you know, and you think, if someone Jewish were sitting here, what would they be thinking?
I went to the Grand Canyon and did a raft trip, and while we were down, after a week we were down there, they had an American Indian wedding with some of the people who were on the trip with us, and we sat in a circle with rocks. There was like 20 of us there, and it was very traditional. They talked to the stars and the wind and the fire and the water and the sun, and it was very interesting. We're not allowed to take pictures. They gave us certain things to wear. Each person talked in the circle, around the circle. Very reverent, earthy.
Earthy.
You know?
Well, my first interreligious experience, and I call it interreligious, although most people wouldn't, was at a Lutheran church. I grew up Finnish Lutheran. Very low church, all Finnish. You are born into it. You have to have a last name like mine, Suomala, to be a part of it. My husband calls them a cult, but I wouldn't go that far. I visited my friend at an ELCA Lutheran church, and I remember exactly the church, Oak Knoll Lutheran Church, and I remember the green hymnals and, like, trying to find things. And I was absolutely dumbstruck. Not in awe, let me tell you. They have to read words. There's no spirit in it. Because we're a little bit more pietist, these Finns. Right? We don't look it, you know, in terms of that charismatic. But yeah, and I remember that so clearly. Like, wow. Can they be worshiping God? I wondered. It took me a couple of years to figure that out. It took me a couple of years. Many, in fact. Are they worshiping God? Is it real?
Well, what did you decide?
Well, I'm not. Jury's still out. Part of the enemy, because my tradition didn't have room for women in terms of higher education. I considered ordained ministry, and that was just not even a possibility. Women couldn't read during the service. We couldn't have female ushers, for goodness sakes. So those are sorts of things. So I was sort of, you know, had to look elsewhere, and I found my way into those circles. So my first participation fully as a not a member, but in the ELCA was the day I showed up at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago for grad school, because they took me in, all right? And I the only way I could get in, you need a recommendation from your pastor. And I went to my pastor. I said, I want to go to study here. He said, I'll only write you a recommendation if you promise not to become ordained. Yeah, I zipped right in, and that was my transition. That was my transition. It took a little while. And you know, it was really exciting, because I think some of the most freeing parts of it for me were like, wow, they believe in God, but they can drink. They can dance. They can have pierced ears. Yeah. I was like, wow, these are crazy people. And sometimes, you know, so our interreligious experiences are things that stick in our memory. As I heard the conversation going, it looks as if everybody remembered, whether positive or negative, but you remember it, especially the first time you do something very different, right? So there is something interesting, unique, hard to define when people of different faith traditions come together and worship together, or at least worship in the presence of each other. Sometimes there's an awkwardness. What am I supposed to do? What happens next? Should I say this? Should I not say this? Should I stand up? Should I? Because you're just not quite sure. You're just not, there's a lot of uncertainty. Sometimes there's fear. Sometimes there's fear that goes along with those experiences. The case study I want to take a look at today is called Trouble in Troy. It's based on, this is a real event. This happened in 2004 in Troy, Michigan, Michigan's second most diverse city. A lot of the background is here. This is a case study that goes for, you know, 6 pages. But what I'm going to try to do is summarize the key points for you, and then we're going to take a look at some of the issues involved, try to sort those out. So, first thing, National Day of Prayer, first observed in Troy, Michigan in May 1995. This emerged out of a congressional sort of edict in 1988, establishing a National Day of Prayer. And Troy started celebrating it within a few years, okay? And you can see, if you've got your handout, this is the actual proclamation of the National Day of Prayer that the city of Troy issued in 1996, right after the first day of prayer. And they, you know, borrowed a lot of the language from the federal one. Whereas in 1775, the Continental Congress declared the first National Day of Prayer, and in 1952, both houses of Congress called on the president to set aside one day each year as the National Day of Prayer. And whereas on May 5th, 1988, so then the first Thursday in May was set aside for that. And they kind of go through. Now, what I think is particularly interesting about Troy's proclamation, and I would just like to read that really briefly in terms of their rationale for it. It's very interesting. Why do we need a National Day of Prayer? Well, according to the city of Troy, whereas the United States of America is beset with a tidal wave of violence, both juvenile and adult, teenage pregnancies, dysfunctional families, and a host of problems which are tearing apart our societal fabric. And whereas it is no coincidence that these problems are occurring as values of faith are swept from the public square, replaced by postmodern moral relativism, which rejects concepts such as right and wrong and personal responsibility. And whereas such a philosophy is at odds with the heritage of Americans who historically have shared a broad consensus of religiously inspired transcendent values, even while insisting on religious freedom. All right, so they take a look, and then the next one, whereas the power of prayer and the power of God through prayer have been at the core of the shared American experience through history. That rationale is particularly interesting. What do you think about that?
It's only academic.
Academic? I saw you shaking your head back here. What are you thinking?
Well, it's clearly it's such a bias in writing this and such a perspective that I'm surprised the council voted for it. I mean, it makes a judgment call that I'm sure a lot of people would argue with. But it's got an agenda right there.
Right there. It's pretty clearly laid out. National Day of Prayer, this whole thing was pushed by James Dobson and his wife. Often part of the religious right, so a lot of the language comes from them. But it's interesting that the city of Troy adopted some of that language wholesale. Yeah, America's in the trouble it is because we've lost our values, we've lost our sense of God. A Christian God is very clearly implied here. All right, and this, like I said, 1996, that's not that long. That's now for the most part. You know, as a city declaration. At any rate, so they've done this, and they've been having this by May 2004, they've been having this National Day of Prayer event for 10 years. It had been organized by Christians, and the prayers were Christian. And it was held on the Veterans Plaza, which was right on the steps of the city hall, and the mayor and many city officials participated every year. All right, so there was this big thing, Christian, and the trouble starts when a woman named Padma Kupa, a Hindu resident of Troy, Michigan, who was also very involved in Troy city politics and outreach for her Hindu temple, outreach meaning promoting understanding, not proselytism or conversion, And she thought maybe, you know, she'd met the organizer of this National Day of Prayer. Her name is Lori Wagner, and these are real names. And she'd met this woman, Lori, on some of the committees she served on, and she found out about the National Day of Prayer. She hadn't heard about it before in that April of 2004. And she thought, oh my gosh, the Hindu community should be involved. They're one of the fastest growing religious communities. She said, we need to be represented there. We want to participate in that. We believe in Troy. We believe that we have something to offer. So she contacted her, Lori, her acquaintance, and said, Lori, you know, can we be part of this? Lori, the response she got back was, oh, programs are already printed, too late. Can't participate. And this is in April. It's like, how much of a program is there? So she thought, you know, this just doesn't sound right. I just, you know, I would have been in the game earlier if I'd known about it. So she contacted the city hall. She wrote, emailed the mayor. Said, listen, you know, I think the Hindus should have a presence there. I'd love to participate. We want to be there. And the mayor said, sure. What we'll do, since the program set out, is I'll just give you some of my time allotment. You can pray, you know, and I'll turn the microphone over to you. So the mayor had her words. Her name was Louise Schilling. Passes the microphone to Padma Kupa, who then did a Hindu prayer. Om Shanti, across the plaza. First time that National Day of Prayer in Michigan, Troy, Michigan, had a non-Christian voice. Now, that's when it gets interesting. After that, there's a lot of controversy, a lot of discussion. You have a group who said, finally, right. Troy is a city of relatively affluent, relatively diverse, high level of education. Their schools have been voted some of the best in the United States. So you had a big group of people who said, you know, this is great. It's about time we, you know, show the diversity of our community. But you had another big group of people who said, this isn't the God we pray to. This is not the God of our founding fathers. We can't have Hindus pray in public. It's America, they said. Yeah. So you start getting this controversy. Well, it kind of subsided for the time being. National Day of Prayer comes up again the next year. Planning starts in February. And Padma Kupa wants to make sure that she can, you know, participate. Meanwhile, Lori, all right, sends her request, because you have to make a request to the city council every year to be able to use this Veterans Plaza, the civic space, but she adds, she tweaks her request this year as the organizer, and this is on page 4, right at the top. This is a copy, and these are actual copies of the quotes and emails that were sent. She says, so she writes to a friend of hers at City Hall, you know, informally, hi there, Cindy, hope this is a better time for you now that the ball field issue is settled. I am writing to request a spot on the agenda to obtain permission from the council for the National Day of Prayer, Troy Judeo-Christian Observance to be held at City Hall on Thursday, May 5th, at noon. She has now decided that it should be a Judeo-Christian Observance. That way they can kind of, you know, good weeding out language. And she wants it specifically like that. Padma Kupa gets wind of that and says, I don't think this is going to work. And she said, I don't know where else to turn. She said, I'm kind of being frozen out of this conversation. So she turned to others in her community, the Baha'i community, Muslims, some of the Jewish rabbi. And they said, you know, you're absolutely right. This should be open to everybody. And so she writes her letter to City Hall. City Council then has to meet. They're like, uh-oh. And it was a very, very heated meeting. So you had people from both sides, and other players were getting involved now. The city attorney, the Thomas More Law School, you know, so you get all these other figures who are trying to navigate the issues that are there, and they're trying to figure out what should be done. All right. So there are a couple of things that they tried to figure out. All right. And they thought, well, can't, you know, so they were kind of wrestling with resolutions. First of all, they had to vote on this resolution that Lori had said. Should it be a Judeo-Christian event? They voted on it. It went down. Did not pass. So no, not a Christian, Judeo-Christian event. But the National Day of Prayer organizer said, we will not pray with non-Christians on our National Day of Prayer. So another city council meeting. This is now March. What do we do? They said, well, maybe we could have do it sequentially. Some faith groups could come in for an hour, and then the next set of faith groups, and then the Christians, and then we could just sort of do it a whole day. And the rabbi and others at that meeting spoke up and said, what's the point? We don't want to be segregated by faith traditions. So then eventually a resolution came about, and so they wrestled with this and wrestled with this, and what they came to after a few more meetings was that this interfaith group that now had organized around Padma, Kupa, and many others who had similar interests, they what the city council said, the interfaith group can have Veterans Plaza from 11 till noon, and then the Christians can have it from noon to 1. And that's what they settled on. After that, then the interfaith group said, withdrew their request. They said, well, we don't really want to be part of it. If we're going to be segmenting it like that, we'll just go to a church or a house of worship in our community and invite everybody who wants to come. So that's pretty much where it's been at.
Is this conservative Christian voice the only Christian voice in Troy? I mean, were there no other? I mean, it does mention a Methodist pastor, but I'm a little surprised there wasn't some other voice who said, well, we would like to participate, but they don't want to. I mean,
well, the organizers tended to be particularly conservative. And many of the other Christians were more interested in a broader interfaith movement. So yeah, but there was a lot of inter-Christian struggle too, but the people who had been holding up the banner organizing this, and I think partly because of the Dobson Christian Right connection, the more liberal Christians tended not to be so interested in National Day of Prayer or, you know, be part of organizing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does.
So it wasn't their issue.
Right.
So when they entered the debate, then they were looking more at the interfaith group. And then there were probably a lot of Christians in the middle. I mean, how many people really attend these sorts of things? 300? All right, so you kind of have your key supporters. Yeah, so it was a little bit tricky. So lots of issues here, a lot of different issues that emerge in this National Day of Prayer. All right. Now, one of those issues, and we're going to put that on the side right now, are the constitutional legal issues. Civic space, religion in America. That's a whole different debate. Totally important, but we're going to shelve it right now. Okay? What we want to talk about is how these different groups can get together, and what is it, first of all, about Lori Wagner's position, because she's sort of the face of the National Day of Prayer movement. What do you think her concerns are about praying with non-Christians? Let's just try to get into her mindset and not sort of, you know, and not say, oh, she doesn't have a legitimate stance. Uh-huh.
I think it's so important to her think about the fact that probably some of her concerns has less to do with her religion or anyone else's religion and more to do with the fact that she's been organizing this for 10 years, and she probably has a lot of her ego wrapped up in it. And this is something that she's always been a leader on. And she may even be supportive of the idea of an interfaith prayer service, but she would rather see it done on a different date or separately from the specific prayer.
They have letters from her, and she wrote quite a lot on this, and she said she wasn't. She said if people want to pray together, they can do that, but this is not here.
Yeah.
And so it was very civic. It had a lot to do with her national identity and things like that. And she didn't want to necessarily participate in an interfaith setting. Yeah. Other reasons. What kinds of concerns does she have?
When I've listened to some of these right-wing radio shows of religious right, I hear things about Muslims. Well, they call their God Allah, and like Allah is different from God.
Right.
And so it's like praying, it's not praying to God if they pray to Allah or any other. It's like praying to a different God, not as God.
And for Christians, a not real God.
Yeah.
An idol.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I think that cuts to the heart of the issue. What does the term God mean? It's a pretty big term, and people have defined it. How do they define it? How do we each define it? We didn't do it instinctually at birth. We didn't come out of the womb knowing how to define God. We learned it. Where did we learn how to define God? Parents, families, churches.
Our friends?
Friends?
What we read.
School sometimes?
What? Read in the newspaper, see in the
newspapers,
media?
Yeah.
TV.
What?
TV.
TV?
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes, too, when you open up everything and put it together, it makes it more difficult for people to figure out what they really believe, and that's scary. I mean, within our own family, we have some groups, there, some of the family way over on very conservative side, and they often have made the comment that, well, you know, if you don't do this, it's easier being a Christian because you don't have to live up to certain standards. And yet, my feeling in some ways is it's almost the opposite, because you don't have to think. You don't have to figure everything out. Somebody's always telling you what's right and what's wrong. You don't have to figure it out for yourself.
You know, a lot of times, okay, this debate turns into one of liberal and conservative, as if one side, and when we listen to Rush Limbaugh-type radio, then one side is villainized. And if you look at, like, the Rachel Maddow show or, you know, others, then it's the other side that's villainized, or, like, the Daily, you know, Daily Show, those things, different things. How part of our dilemma in interreligious dialogue is to see each other as whole people with points of view, and that sometimes is so difficult. It's very, very difficult. You had your hand up.
Yeah. The National Day of Prayer is kind of broad. And I wonder if one of her thoughts might have been, well, we want to worship and pray with people who believe that Jesus Christ is our Son, the Son of God and our Savior.
Right.
In which case you could call it National Worship Christ Day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So they pray, and that's kind of why she said a Judeo. She tried to further define it because that was what she was thinking. Well, National Day of Prayer, that just leaves it wide open. Well said, yes.
I think there's a lot of difference, too, of thinking about my God and our God.
Right. My God as almost, Diana Eck has a beautiful statement about that in her book, and it just made so much sense to me. The sense of ownership, America as an ownership society, she talks about, and we're talking about religious pluralism in America. It's my house, it's my property, it's my gun, it's my car, it's my, you know, my future, my education. She said, we have such a sense of ownership that God starts falling into that category too. It's mine and not yours. And she said, when we start to get possessive of God, that's when we start running into trouble. Yeah, back?
Yeah. I think there's an issue of a sense of faithfulness. It seems to me that a belief in a God,
right,
which, well, everybody wants to believe is absolute, mm-hmm, becomes lost in pluralism, and I think this is the dilemma of a pluralistic attempt. You have to be tolerant, and therefore you can't insist that your own belief has any validity more than anybody else,
yes,
and that uncomfortableness of that. You aren't being faithful.
So because it be apparently because of our sense of possessiveness, and this isn't just an American trait, this has emerged from our biblical text, this isn't, you know, sort of thing, and it's worked perfectly with the American sense of ownership. So you get, you know, those two things together.
I think when you hear some people say this is a Christian nation,
right,
they forget that they talk about the founding fathers and all that, mm-hmm, but not all of them believed in Jesus. I mean, some of them were atheists.
Deists. Let's go for just one second. One more comment. Yeah.
Well, you were just saying what could be going through her mind.
Yeah.
There are, you know, people who feel you have to draw the line somewhere.
Right.
In the same way that, you know, we wouldn't think that the Earth is Flat Society should be able to have a space in our textbooks to teach our students in school.
Right.
There are those who feel that Christianity is the only, you know, way to worship God, and so if you let these others in, it, you know, it's ridiculous in the same way that the Flat Earth Society being talked about in school would be ridiculous. And I think that is a point a lot of people feel.
So it's like incompatible worldviews. They just aren't going to mesh.
Yeah, because if the point of prayer day is to pray to God, mm-hmm, and the other people aren't praying to God, then why are you including them? Because they're praying to non-gods.
So what's at stake for Lori in her heart, in her soul? She opens this up. What is she fearing? What are her deepest concerns?
I think she'd be fearing rejection by her basic religious group, and she would lose her face, she would lose her faith. And
her credibility,
And I think the thing that people feel most in life, no matter what situation, is rejection.
Right, so she's worried that, because this is her stance, she's done this for 10 years, and she starts letting people in, what is her community going to say to her, her core community?
Yeah, you aren't doing a good job, I think you're sinful.
You're watering it down, why are you doing this? Yep.
I really think it's larger than Lori, because there are stories of this sort in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, the pastor who in Shea Stadium, was he defrocked or kicked out of the Synod? Missouri Synod Lutheran. But many of my family are very much like Lori Wagner, and for them, they're being faithful to this biblical notion of one God and a supreme God, and you don't tolerate others. And I think the confusion is we are in America, and I have a strong sympathy with their belief that of trying to be faithful to the biblical teaching.
Right.
And so if you want to, I'd like to see you go there.
That's where we're in terms of that idea, because that's what we're trying to get. Notice the language she used in her email, Judeo-Christian. She was open to Jews participating. She was open to Jews participating, not to Muslims.
And that's been part of that language.
Right.
But that is really the issue there, is being faithful to their authority of the Bible.
To one God.
Yes.
To one God. And if you,
and
in Hindu,
right,
and in Hindu tradition, there isn't that. There's a sense of unity and oneness, but it's expressed very differently.
You won't find Orthodox Muslims participating in this either.
No. Or Orthodox Jews.
Or Orthodox Jews.
Orthodox anything.
Well, yeah.
Hindus.
Right, Hindus. Because she said it's, you can be Orthodox Hindu, I guess, if that's possible. But you're exactly right. It's that oneness. What do you do if this is at the center of your core of being? You're grounded in this notion of oneness, and this is your experience, your knowledge of God in absolute terms, and somebody who has a religious experience and tradition that's different than yours, where there is the possibility of manyness. So for her, it's threatening that key point she might be willing to give on others. She's not advocating go out and get rid of Hindus. She just said, just not here, because it's just too threatening to that core. And what do people do from one God traditions or the monotheistic traditions? What do they do when they encounter traditions of manyness? Yeah, often reject it. And there are a lot of terms that we use. Are there ways for people from traditions, one God traditions, to interact, to encounter, to honor people from traditions of manyness? What are your thoughts on that? Are there ways that our theologies allow us to do that, particularly from a Christian tradition?
You indulge in that. I was kind of thinking about this earlier in the week, and I wrote this kind of a random thought thing. Earth, wind, fire, water, mediums of the Creator, ancient legends, mythology, other religions, and all understand some aspect of God the Creator. Instinctively, but in the same manner we might understand a platypus, if we were each given only one small part of it. As theologians, professional, amateur, we understand God as a small child might, but become arrogant in our own understanding. The Bible's the word of God through the filter of human language. As such, we need more than just it to forge our relationship to our Creator. We need to open ourselves to experiences that put us in harmony with His creation. When we are, God can't teach it. God can teach us to interpret and understand His words more readily in spite of language difficulties. Mm-hmm. It's like He gives us a big picture to measure the details against, to measure and explore in order to find out how or why they fit. We can't do this through our own intellect, only under our Lord's guidance.
I think that is one of the avenues that Christians, particularly through theology, have looked towards this, looking at the idea of God, kind of where we started out, definitions of God. If Christians see God as the infinite, the boundless, so great that we can't put limits on that. Defining God, that's what the word definition means, to put limits on, to put lines around, to box in. So if we can accept that, that God is infinite and that we might not understand how this God is expressed. You've had your hand up.
I'm part of an interfaith youth group in my my city in Minneapolis. And I think it's a lot easier for people who are younger to focus on other things where we're the same. Mm-hmm. And because we're not all completely sure of our faith and we're not willing to do a lot of stuff in like the name of God or whatever, but we go to each other's places of worship every week and that's where we meet. It's a lot easier for us and we connect on other levels rather than if we pray to one God or many gods or no God at all.
So the level of relationship.
Yeah, you don't have to agree on everything.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. I went to a Hindu sort of ceremony in India, and at this huge, huge temple where just thousands and millions of people come through every day, and we actually had to sign a book before we went in saying that we, and it was my brother and my sister-in-law, wanted to go to their thing, and we had to sign to say that we sort of bought, you know, were a part of this, and then on the way out through the temple, you stop and you pause before all of these different statues and, you know, do a little, you know, make a little offering to each of them.
Right.
And we sat through the whole ceremony, which was in a different language. I had no idea what was going on. It was hot. And I would say that it made me really uncomfortable. And that, like, even though I could respect I totally admired the reverence all of these people had for these different statues and forms, and I could totally buy into that, and you know, that this was a powerful moment for all of them, but it wasn't for me.
Not in that way.
Not in that way, right. I mean, in other ways.
Other ways.
I mean, it was very powerful. But I just wonder with this National Day of Prayer, like, I think there's a difference between, you know, from very many different faiths, we're all here, we're all praying in the same room together,
right.
And that's great, versus someone's going to say a Hindu prayer or a prayer in a different language that I don't understand and that I'm supposed to be participating in that as though that's my belief. Because I can tell you from walking through and bowing before these statues that was not, I respect it, but it didn't feel the same as...
Well, in some ways, you might feel like a fraud.
Right, yeah, totally.
Not to put you down, but I've had that experience. I don't want to feel like a fraud.
Right.
In a situation where people have a powerful experience.
Right.
And I'm like...
what's going on? Right. And so I'm just wondering if in this National Day of Prayer, if all of these... If prayers are being uttered in languages people don't understand, mm-hmm. that are religions that people don't entirely understand, I can understand. As liberal as I am, like, I don't feel like it's all one and the same, and I feel comfortable, like, in praying all of those prayers
right.
with those other religions. I feel comfortable being in the same room and saying we're all offering up prayers together. But
and I think that's kind of what is done, because the prayer that she did, it had the Hindi, but also translation.
Okay.
So you know, and often that happens.
Okay.
And sometimes the prayers aren't so based on meaning, but it's the tone. Uh-huh. So that... You know, so even that, we're getting into this whole thing, tone, you know, as opposed to some of these other sorts of things. But yeah, there was no sense that people had to pray these prayers.
Okay.
But you're, another issue, how close do we want to get? Can you can see the reverence in someone else. Can you take on the reverence yourself? Yeah.
It seems to me that Christianity does have some harsh things that you can't avoid. When Christ says you can't come to the Father but through me,
mm-hmm.
that's fairly exclusivistic.
Mm-hmm.
If we wish to really share with others,
mm-hmm.
I think we have to get away from particularizing and tend to universalize.
Mm-hmm.
So that you learn, universalize your values, you universalize the qualities of God that seem very similar, similar stories, similar expectations of human behavior across most of these religions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel offended. I actually did a similar thing and I led a group in India, and we went to a Hindu place, and we got blessed. And there was a Lutheran pastor with me who shunned that, and it didn't bother me at all. And I accepted the fact that it was a reverence for something more, and that was enough for me.
No, it wasn't a reverence for you, but it was, you know, and I think, you know, there has been that trend in the ecumenical movement, in interreligious dialogue, let's find our common ground. And that has been probably the biggest trend of the last 30 years. What can we agree on? What do we have in common? And it's important. But interreligious dialogue and participants now are saying, but wait a minute. That kind of sometimes leaves us at a very shallow place. Once you could just say, well, let's just talk about the things that we have in common. What about all that other stuff that we don't? That really makes us unique and special and that are very powerful. What do we do with the stuff that's different? That's, you know, what this whole week, you know, what do we do with the difference? And you're right, there is that searching for common ground, but there's also, what do we do with the different stuff? The stuff that makes us uncomfortable.
In preparation for this week, a number of young people from our church read a book called The Shack.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded with the scriptural quote here, I'm reminded of a place where the Christ is talking to this main character in the book, and the main character says something like, oh, so any path will get me to God.
Right.
And Christ says, no, many paths lead nowhere, but I can follow through any path to get to you.
There's another way of looking at that. Luther dealt with this question. I'll get in because people said, well, if you don't know Christ, you know, people around the world, because even in Luther's time, this question was starting just very prematurely to come up. Well, what about all the other people who never know about Christ? And Luther said, and I think it was wise on his part, not everything he said it was wise, especially when it came to interreligious relations. Luther and the Jews is a whole other topic, and it's a horrendous place sometimes to visit. The issue, what he said, though, is, he says, what I can say from what I know is that Christ saved me. This I know. How all those other people come to God is not something that I have to account for. I'm not asked to account for them. And he did go to the bigness of God argument. All right? He didn't say Christ isn't the only, he said, for me, it is, because Christ has, you know, grasped me. But then he kind of stopped there. And it was that sense of kind of, I think, one of those rare moments that he had of humility. And
yes. I'm feeling anxious during this. I'm Jewish. So I'm just sharing that because this is the outside. I just want to share the other side. So I married one of the Johnsons who were
searching for which one.
So, and we almost didn't get married. We dated for 5 years trying to figure out if our religions were going to keep us apart. And finally, after much struggling, decided we believed in the same God and that God would have no part of keeping us apart when we're meant to be together. I know not everybody agrees with that, thankfully. I think a lot of the Johnsons. But I just have to share a moment. So one of my brothers-in-law is a pastor, Jim. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm just outing everybody. So I've gone to church very much, more than I've gone to synagogue in the last. We've been married for a long time, 26 years.
Yeah. 26?
All right. Yeah. And so the other night, I've gone to the Eucharist in services with my in-laws who are here. I love them very much. My parents were on staff. I just want to say that Holden can be very inclusive. Most of the time, I really feel at home. So we're at the Eucharist the other night, and my daughter's sitting next to me, who's 11. And whenever it says, all are welcome to come, I go up and ask for a blessing. Mm-hmm. Which feels fine. If they don't say that, I don't want to confuse the poor pastor. So the other night, I was going, well, should I go? They didn't say anything. And Jim's got he says, all are welcome to share. He's pointing at the back. Yeah. And I said, well, but I don't usually, you know, I ask for a prayer. No, it says right here, you're welcome to go up with your daughter. And Tessa's going, I want the bread. So here we are.
at our funeral. I think we need a bigger discussion about this than deciding when we're going up right now. So I went up, and I love Jim. He's so open-minded. He's helped me so much understand how this is all working. So I went up. I chickened out at the end, but I burst into tears. It was a moment of, I don't know, and Jim kept saying, you're worried about, I said, I don't know, what would my parents have thought of this? I don't, what did people hear? It's my reaction is out of deference for you all for whom that has a meaning, mm-hmm. and I don't want to disrespect that. So anyway, it's just a moment I'm just sharing with you all of how it feels to be here.
But it had a meaning for you, but a different one.
A different meaning.
A communal meaning. There was meaning in community that was there.
I love going there because I feel part of this family and this community. I think it's the same God. I love what Jesus had to teach. I see him in a different way,
right.
But I don't reject him. People say, oh, that's the big sticking point, and it's not.
The big J.
The big J. I think he's wonderful.
You know, I think this is like a perfect comment to kind of wrap up today, because this is what interreligious dialogue in America looks like today. We see it in these well-publicized situations, National Day of Prayer, who can do it, but where it's really, really happening, where, you know, kind of like the rubber hits the road, people are not at prayer together. They're living together. They're married to each other. This is families working out an interreligious life. This is not no longer a theoretical thing for many millions of Americans. It's not something that they need to work out theologically, theoretically, like, if I were to encounter. No, you're sitting in the pew, you're saying, I'm Jewish, I'm in a Christian setting, should I go up to Eucharist now or not? Yeah. This is what American pluralism, the new face of it, is really looking like. It's in the lived life experiences of people every day, and a lot of things are involved, especially when you bring in family and children and religion. I mean, that's just the whole ball of wax right there. It's already hard enough if everybody agrees more or less. You know? So I think those are some of the pieces that we're taking a look at as we explore this. You may kind of be thinking about these conversations as we move on to tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be taking a look at another interesting case study. It's about Muslim taxi drivers at the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport who refused to transport passengers who had alcohol in them or who looked drunk. Yeah, it's a tricky situation, and they had faith reasons for doing it. And then you have the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport Commission getting involved trying to figure out how to navigate this. As you go from today, and as you talk about this case with others, and you have a copy here, continue to think about what is motivating Lori. What kinds of answers might you give to her? We didn't get to Padma Kupa. What is motivating her? What is she thinking about all this?
Her what it is to be an American. Her identity as an American is really wrapped up, and this
right.
is a challenge.
Does it also have something to do with her roots within Hinduism?
Well, yeah, I mean, as a Hindu.
As a Hindu and participating in, yeah. But it's complicated, but it's a mix of, especially when you get nationality, you know, all these other different pieces there. Exactly. But yeah, what it means to be an American, you participate. All right. Also, the compromise that they came up with at first, and it didn't eventually work out, but two slots on Veterans Plaza. What do you think about that? Good? Bad? Other way? I mean, would you have accepted that if you were at the negotiating table? Yeah, I don't know. These are, you know, talk about that, and maybe we'll be open tomorrow and see kind of where people are at. Some of these things I realize we could go on for hours, but thank you very much for coming today.